Next up, Muck versus Pearson.
I'd like to reserve, with the court's permission, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead, Mr. Gould. I'll master this at some point.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm Robert Gould, counsel for appellants Monk and White River Feed. The decision of the trial court in this case in granting summary judgment of dismissal on summary judgment grounds is, I respectfully submit, an evisceration of this court's well-known and appropriate decision in Janicki Logging. Janicki Logging, as this court knows only so well, has a very salutary foundation and public policy. In our views, Your Honor, this case fits like a hand to a glove, Janicki, where this court says at page 660, Janicki knew or should have known when its claim was dismissed as untimely that its lawyer missed a deadline, 660. This court went on to say, the question here is whether the statute of limitations should be told until the end of the representation, and I emphasize the following words, even if the client has knowledge of the facts supporting the claim, page 662. Judge White, in his unique and exhaustive decision of September 22, 2008, of 110 pages, gives a blueprint of gross negligence and greed and ill-founded litigation on the part of Mr. Pearson. What is the layman? And we must always bear in mind, we're all here as lawyers trained in the law. This is a layman who comes before you. And to quote Judge White, what was Monk to make of all of this? Presumably, he had no idea that his attorney was engaging in meritless litigation. And that is, in fact, the case. This comes before you on a CR 56 basis. The commissioner of this court, Commissioner Neal, said in her order of August 13, 2012, in denying the petition for discretionary review, and I quote, the issue in this case will be resolved by an appeal pending in this court, Monk versus Dreesen. Discretionary review is not warranted. All of the parties here before you today were before Commissioner Neal when she issued her order. This court in Dreesen educated the party and certainly this lawyer, because I want to take responsibility. This type A lawyer read the words of King County versus Sea West to say, and I quote, there was not a compulsory counterclaim under CR 13A. This court in Dreesen educated the parties in front of it and certainly this lawyer to make the distinction between a motion and a pleading, and held as a matter of law in Dreesen that this does not bar my clients from proceeding on res judicata grounds against Pearson, which brings us here today. To quote this court in Dreesen at page 8, quote, because neither CR 13 nor res judicata bars Monk from bringing a malpractice action against Pearson. There's another aspect of this that I'd like to briefly address with the court, and that's the unique area of the law of the subjective intent of a client as it relates to the existence or non-existence of an attorney-client relationship. Starting back in In re McLaughlin, Bone versus Cody, and there have been other citations that do not come to my mind post Bone versus Cody. And the law as it exists says the client's subjective intent of the existence of an attorney-client relationship is one of the few areas of which this council is aware of where subjective intent, as contrasted with objective manifestations, will be taken into consideration, provided, however, that that subjective intent is reasonable regarding the, quote, attendant circumstances, end quote. In that regard, Your Honor, I commend this panel's attention to Clerk's Papers 39, the declaration of David Monk in this matter, which is before you, of March 9, 2012, and Clerk's Papers 102, his declaration of December 21, 2012. And in there, he logically, as a sentient economic person, says, up until Judge White issued his 110-page decision, I thought my interests were aligned with Mr. Pearson because whatever he could get and he represented, and again we need to bear in the foundation that he represented to Monk that all of your attorney's fees and costs would be awarded by the court. It was until Judge White issued his decision that I came to realize that our economic interests were divergent as opposed to unified.
For all, I ask you this: is what you just read, is that your claim of malpractice, that he did not tell me, he let me think I was going to get all my attorney's fees and costs?
Thank you, Judge Becker, for asking that. That's one of the reasons. But Your Honor, I incorporate by reference Judge White's 110-page decision, which lays out a roadmap of everything wrong that Mr. Pearson did. In my experience, I have never seen a 110-page decision as thorough, as exhaustive, as detailed as that given by Judge White. The answer, yes, coupled with the incorporation by reference of Judge White.
I'm not sure that helps me decide what your claim of malpractice is. I mean, I assume that when you would try this case to the jury, if you did, you'd stand up and it wouldn't take you 109 pages to tell the jury what you thought Mr. Pearson's malpractice was. So perhaps on rebuttal you can reflect on that.
I'll be happy to. Thank you for your attention.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Pam DeVette. I'm here for respondents, cross appellants, Pearson. And I've handed up a small handful of pieces of paper, and counsel has a copy of the same. Mr. Monk and his business hired Mr. Pearson to represent him in a trespass and takings action against two of the cities in the South End. Mr. Monk sued Pearson later for advising him, and I think this goes to your question, Judge Becker, for advising him to pursue what he calls a baseless claim and advising him that all expenses of the action could be recovered. Now, Mr. Pearson denies negligence, and there is no adjudication at all of the case in chief of the plaintiffs in this matter. We have had a lot of motions practice about our defenses, but nothing deciding whether there's been negligence or not. So I'd like to draw your attention first to this decision tree graphic that I've given you. On the left-hand side, is the decision regarding the summary judgment motion that got us here, the one in which the court determined that Mr. Monk had not met the statute of limitations. And then on the right-hand side is the alternate basis we presented to this court to affirm the trial court's dismissal of the action. Today I want to concentrate on the left side of the decision tree because I think that it is all that this court has to do. The statute of limitations for a claim of attorney negligence is 3 years, and for a CPA claim is 4 years. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, but yes, there is math. But if I can do it, anyone can. One begins counting from the time that the former client had discovered the facts giving rise to the cause of action. And if the attorney continues to represent the client, the continuous representation tolls the statute of limitation. Now, Your Honors, my opponent has put it forth to you as if I'm ignoring one or two of those rules, but actually, I'm not. Let's first turn to the discovery rule, which says that the statute of limitations begins to run when the client discovers, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence, should have discovered the facts giving rise to the cause of action. On our second graphic here, we have a very brief timeline that touches on some of the key events in this case. Mr. Monk has the burden here to show that he didn't discover or could not have discovered the facts, and I present to you the notion, Your Honor, that he did not meet that burden on summary judgment. Also, it's very clear, according to the jurisprudence of Washington State, that it's not about discovering that you have a cause of action against somebody, and it's not about discovery of the full extent of the damages in the case. The alleged negligence, again, is that Pearson advised Monk to pursue a baseless claim, and also that he advised Monk that all expenses of the action would be recovered. And in September of 2003, most of those claims were lost on summary judgment, including what's now being called the baseless claim. And in March 2004, he lost the rest of them at trial. According to Richardson versus Denon and Janicki logging, those two first events give Mr. Monk constructive knowledge that something might have gone wrong. But we don't rely on constructive knowledge in this case, Your Honors, because we go on to places where he had actual knowledge. Mr. Monk hired substitute counsel when he went on appeal. And substitute counsel...
You're talking about John Groen.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I am. When he first met with substitute counsel, he said, I had this burning question I wanted to ask him, and was that Mr. Pearson's advice to me incorrect? And John Groen confirmed that it was, that they're not going to reimburse all of my expenses, that Pearson's been wrong about that all along. This really angered Mr. Monk, and he just stopped talking to Mr. Pearson at all. In the clerk's papers around page 498, there is the testimony about him saying, well, I thought it was in my best interest to just stop communicating with Mr. Pearson. And he also tried to keep his appeal and Mr. Pearson's Rule 11 appeal separate at the Court of Appeals. And when it got to the point of oral argument, they came to this court and they sat together, but Mr. Monk did not want to do that. He didn't even want to say hello, but he did because Mr. Pearson said hello to him. Then when the Court of Appeals made its decision in the city's case on August 8, 2005, Mr. Monk had further actual knowledge that the advice, if it ever happened, was that about all expenses being recovered was incorrect, and in fact, the summary judgment was affirmed so that the baseless claim was considered to be the same by this court as well. Mr. Monk testified at the clerk's papers 493. It took me all the way to the Court of Appeals and talking to John Groen before I realized that the things I was being told were not accurate. He tells you right there, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals clued him in to the situation. And if you use the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, which, by the way, says at page 502 in the clerk's papers, because the city's made no offer of settlement before that date, they are liable for the reasonable attorney's fees and the reasonable expert witness fees incurred by Monk in connection with the claim he tried. That is, the reasonable fees, not all of them, and the reasonable fees related to one claim, not all claims. And this is something that he knew in August of 2005. Also in the Court of Appeals opinion, and this is at page 510 of the clerk's papers, Monk learned that the claim of substantial impairment of access, the one that had been dismissed on summary judgment in September 2003, was properly dismissed. Monk did not set forth specific facts that sufficiently rebut the contentions of the city and disclose the existence of a genuine issue of material fact. So not later than August of 2005, Monk had all the facts supporting his claim against Pearson. And it wasn't for another 6 years that he sued Mr. Pearson. And despite having all the knowledge and recognizing that he had an issue with Mr. Pearson's representation that needed resolution, as he described it in his July 27, 2006 letter, that's at page 612. Despite that, he waited another 5 years after that to sue. At the trial court level, he didn't raise a genuine issue of material fact as to the discovery rule, and the trial court's dismissal on that basis was proper. Moving then to the continuous representation rule, which says that the statute of limitations is told until the end of an attorney representing a client in the same matter. Bone versus Cody, as my opponent cited, says that whether an attorney-client privilege relationship exists turns largely on a client's reasonable leap based on existing circumstances, whether this relationship exists. Mr. Monk puts one piece of evidence before the court, and it's his self-serving declaration that he believed Pearson was his attorney all the way through to September of 2008. But this is clearly not a reasonable belief based on the facts and circumstances. The evidence overwhelmingly shows that Mr. Pearson stopped representing Mr. Monk in 2004 after the trial. And here in the timeline that I've used here, we show that Mr. Monk retained substitute counsel in 2004, right after the trial. And the Janicki court says that the continuous representation rule does not apply to a client who retains new counsel on appeal. And once again, Your Honor, I'm not relying on any sort of technical argument here, because we go further and we have Mr. Monk cutting off communications, trying to keep the appeals separate, and later communicating with Mr. Peterson that the matters that went before were incorrectly done and that Mr. Pearson had charged way too much money anyway. I will also point out that the findings of fact and conclusions of law from the underlying trial said that the representation was from 2002 through 2004, and that's at the clerk's paper is 531 through 534. Mr. Pearson need not formally withdraw for representation to end, and that's in the Lockhart case. And I just would like to end with the notion that there is no evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact that this representation followed anything past 2004. Thank you, Your Honors.
To answer your question, Judge Becker, the gravamen synthesizing the malpractice claims are affirmative misrepresentation and commencement of baseless litigation designed only to line the defendant attorney's pocket at the expense and cost of Monk. And we have alleged and believe that that litigation on the merits will show a pattern and practice on behalf of the defendant lawyer. Having said that, however, Your Honor, that is secondary to the main issue before you, because we don't get that. We've been deprived of our day in court because a wrongful application of the statute of limitations. Additionally, this court should bear in mind this court's appropriate decision in Murphy versus Grass. As borne out under a CR 56 standard, the declarations in front of you, at worst, from the plaintiff's standpoint, client, he did not know the extent of his damages, absolutely congruent with Murphy versus Grass, until Judge White rendered his magnum opus in September. Lockhart versus Grieve is a case that I know quite well, and it's apples to oranges. Please read it if there's any question. In that case, Lockhart knew that there was a termination of the agreement, retained new counsel, and there was a clear understanding that my client, Mr. Murphy, would do nothing further. Counsel is going back to pre-Peters versus Simmons and is, in essence, asking this court to go back to adopt an occurrence statute of limitations. Janicki Logging, and I incorporate by reference the foundation and reasoning behind it, including this court's citation to the appropriate provisions of Mallon and Smith, attempt to preserve the attorney-client relationship and give the attorney an opportunity, in my words, to mitigate and reduce the damages. And that is not addressed by what the court did. The hiring of Gruen was done at the request, a specific request of Mr. Pearson, and Mr. Pearson remained counsel of record, filed declarations in support of attorney's fees. There is no objective manifestation that that came to a cessation. Rather, the genuine issue of material fact, my client felt that their interests were congruent. If we use the measuring stick of a client being angry at an attorney, disliking attorney, which any of you may have had an experience, we're going to have an explosion in legal malpractice, and that's not the test. We ask that you overturn the summary judgment, remand this matter to trial. Thank you for your attention.